Good evening. I'm Mark Leonard. I'm director of the Foreign Policy Centre, and I'm delighted to be able to welcome you here this evening to the LSC for the Foreign Policy Centre's third annual lecture. I'm glad that you all made it here in spite of the last minute change of venue and the protests at the door. It's shown some real commitment, the fact that you're actually in here. The annual lecture is one of the most important events in our calendar. Obviously, you've got to plan these sorts of things months in advance. But the crystal ball seems to be working pretty well again this year. After Lionel Jospin gave the first inaugural lecture, we had a lecture last year with George Robertson, who spoke to us on the very day that the ground troops would have entered into Kosovo, so he claims. And it was immediately after his appointment as General Secretary, Secretary General of NATO. And this year, I think we've done it again, and I'm sure Keith would like to join me in thanking both Anne Widdecombe and Mo Molan for handling the pre-publicity for tonight. I think you'll all agree they've done a fantastic job. The Foreign Policy Centre was created to look for global solutions to domestic problems, and it's very noticeable that in this area, the heat of domestic debate has almost never been set within a global context, even though it's clearly going to be vital for any effective policy response. And that's why we've invited Keith to address these issues tonight. And one way that we're going to try and work to take these issues forward is by working with Rowena Young at Kaleidoscope and Forum, which is a network of 30 drug treatment agencies in Nepal, Cambodia, Malaysia, Sri Lanka, India, Pakistan, all over the world, to look at what works in each of these projects, which are all very innovative, and how they can use entrepreneurship and innovation to reduce the harm that drugs inflict on their communities, and how we can actually cooperate not just on developing a global regime to deal with the supply of drugs, but how we can learn lessons from each other in actually dealing with the problems which inflict individual communities. But that is for later on in the year. Tonight, on behalf of the Foreign Policy Centre, and on your behalf, I'd like to welcome this year's speaker, Keith Hallowell, QPM. It's now over 2 years since he became drug czar, and many governments around the world have been studying his 10-year plan and looking to learn from his model, which he's set out. But he began his working life as a coal miner before enjoying a stellar rise up through the ranks of the police, picking up various academic qualifications on the way and making a name for himself as someone who was dedicated to public works, and finished his career in the police service as Chief Constable of Cleveland, which was then in West Yorkshire. And along the way served in many very challenging locations, from Northern Ireland to a secondment to the LAPD. So I think there are very few people who are better placed to speak about the drugs problem both at home and abroad, and to chart out rational, innovative approaches to deal with it. Ladies and gentlemen, Keith Hallowell.
Well, thank you very much for that, Mark. I intend to talk for about 25 minutes or so and leave plenty of time for questions and discussion. If I don't cover any of the issues or topics that is uppermost in your mind, then I'll certainly be happy to take on board any points or any issues you wish to raise. I think the first thing in wondering what I was going to say this evening is to say that we don't have a settled way of dealing with this problem. I think, in fact, there is a great deal of dispute about whether it is a problem or not. And if it is a problem, then whose problem is it? On one hand, people believe that it is their right to take whatever substances they choose, and in their minds, providing they don't affect other people, then why should society or the community control their behavior and their actions? At the other side of the coin, there is a very strong moralistic approach of people who believe that we need to protect people who are not prepared to protect themselves, and we will use all sorts of means at our disposal to do that. So at the root of this, there isn't an agreed agenda, I think, in terms of what is the problem and what are the most best and effective solutions to address to that problem. I think the second thing I'd like to say by way of introduction is that on an international basis, certainly has not been, up until the last 2 or 3 years, any consistency in approach about how this problem needs to be addressed. I think it's fair to say that the majority of the world communities has seen drug taking and drug use as a criminal justice issue, and for many years has believed that to actually deal with it in a very firm way within the criminal justice system is the way to go. Completely at the opposite end of the spectrum, a fewer number of countries have believed that this is a health issue, that this is something we need to deal with in the health context, that the criminal justice system has actually no place at all in addressing this problem. I would like to believe that each of the ends of that spectrum, each of the ends of that polarization, does not and will not provide the solution. I'd like to convince you in the next few minutes that we need a more balanced approach, a more centrist approach, which actually picks up both sides of that rainbow, as it were, accepts those, recognizes those, but has a balanced policy in which we can take things forward. Whose problem is it anyway? I think there's been a very selfish approach from nation states about their problem. And I think even still today, many countries will see that this is a problem for us, and what we will do, or what interventions we make, or whatever policies we determine beyond these shores, we're not particularly concerned about how that affects other people. What we are concerned about is how that affects us and how that influences and improves the situation in our country. That is normally related to the very hardline approach, this side of the spectrum, where it is the belief that whatever we do is justified in countries where these drugs are grown or in countries where these drugs are processed or transported. There is clearly, in a more enlightened society, a great deal of criticism about those hard-lined approaches. I think if one looks at the discussion there is about Plan Colombia, and particularly the rhetoric that's coming out of the United States about the militarization, the military type, the intervention with different pesticides and different fungi, you can actually see how this debate about the single-minded, perhaps selfish approach on dealing with this problem is coming under greater scrutiny. Coming to the other side of the problem, where a country selfishly says, look, I don't care really what's happening internationally. I care about my citizens. I want to take a liberal approach, and I want my citizens to develop, allow them to do what they choose to do. And providing it's not really affecting anybody else, then why should people tell us in our country that we want people to have the freedom to do as they choose and adopt a very liberal approach? I think it's fair to say that that side of the spectrum is also being questioned. People are saying, well, maybe you feel it doesn't affect anyone else. But if you are harboring or supporting or encouraging or turning a blind eye to people who are supplying this liberal regime, and if you're encouraging people from my country to come into your country to avail themselves of the drugs that are available in takeaway shops virtually, then you actually are affecting us. So I think the idea that either one end of the spectrum in terms of a very liberal approach, a very open approach and a free approach, and the other end of the spectrum of we don't really care what is happening in their countries, what we do care about is us, in my view, is clearly wrong. I think the United Nations conference in June 1998 where all the members of the United Nations discussed this issue and actually recognised that in the past, when they'd largely been dealing with the criminal justice side, and many and most of the agreements were actually aimed at this criminal justice intervention, were wrong. And that there was a time for a change. There was a time to actually move towards recognising that we've got to start to reduce the demand, that we've got to start to deal with the problems that drugs cause, that we've got to start to recognise that the communities and the thousands and tens of thousands of people, innocent people, whose lives depend on growing this product, whose children's livelihood depends on that, needs to be recognised in this equation. I think, in short, for me, and I went to that conference, there was a much more open, if I can call it, centrist approach, a less selfish approach to I'm concerned about me, and a more pragmatic approach, a more honest approach to this problem. If you want examples of areas where international policy, in my mind, at one level, have, in the old view, in the less enlightened environment, have been shown to succeed, one can look at the situation in Pakistan. On one hand, the international community says we are going to eradicate the poppy crop in Pakistan. And there are all sorts of pressures put on about fiscal controls and restraints of trade in order that we bludgeon or encourage, whichever way you put it, the Pakistani government to reduce or eradicate the poppy crop. People are now saying that this is a total success, because the measures by which the international community was addressing that issue in Pakistan was eradicate the poppy crop. But what it has created in its wake is a dependent culture in Pakistan, where up to 4 million of their own population are now addicted to a substance that we've managed to eradicate. So the measures by which, in terms of this selfish approach, we achieve success, in my mind, we have achieved abject failure. And one can actually question, well, why did we? Whose brainchild was it at an international level to decide that what we will do in the Indian-Pakistan continent is we will say to India, look, we want you to grow a poppy for legitimate purposes, and say to Pakistan, we're going to eradicate the poppy crop in your country, otherwise you're going to be in trouble. Who made that decision? How was that decision reached? Was that decision reached with an enlightened view, with a view to how are we going to improve the situation in the world? Or was that decision reached by saying, you know, it's going to affect me, I want you to stop doing it? So I think in addressing this subject now, the international community hasn't just got to look at how whatever happens is going to affect me. It hasn't got to take a selfish view. It's got to say, how is this going to affect the community in which we are going to impose sanctions, we're going to introduce measures, we're going to do whatever we're going to do. And how can we, working with those communities, and how can the international community together say what is going to be the impact on the interventions that we're making? And in many ways, the illogicality of some of that activity, Pakistan perhaps is just one example. I know we're set in a context of great difficulty because of the human rights records and some of the issues that we face in the country where these crops are grown. I don't think anybody is ready to say that we do business on a full scale with the Taliban in Afghanistan. We are certainly working in that direction, and we're doing whatever we can within the context of the international abhorrence at some of the activities of the Taliban. But in looking at our actions in Afghanistan, surely we as an international community should not look 1 year ahead or 2 years ahead, but say, what is going to be the effectiveness and the impact of what we are doing at the moment on that community in 5, 10 years? I don't think we're actually thinking, we're thinking about it, but I don't think the international community is operating together to do that at the moment. I think it's time that it did. So what are we doing when we operate within those countries? What are we doing when we provide money, when we provide support, when we actually provide either military or offensive intervention or actions? I think we need to be clearer about what the end product of our activity is going to be, so that we have an agenda for change, an agenda which will recognize what the consequences of our actions are, not in a year or two, but in a decade. In that regard, I do believe there is better cooperation at an international level. I do believe governments are talking more. One of the initiatives we put on the G8 conference recently in Okinawa was the need for an international conference looking at the economies of the drugs trade. Not just the economies and the criminal justice side of it, but the economies of the countries where these drugs are grown, where people are supported by those economies and by that trade. And that is going to be held in London in February next year. Looking at it at a strategic level, looking to see what is the consequences of our actions at the moment and what are the consequences if we continue as we are. And how do we need to change as an international community if we really are going to make a difference? Clearly, I think there is a better developing way of dealing with the criminal side of this equation and the forgive me for this, but the criminal side of the equation and the aspects where the international community has worked together and has been working together better. That is probably because the emphasis from the international community has largely been on the criminal justice side. We have less evidence, less knowledge, less understanding, less information about how effective demand reduction methodologies or interventions are. And in fact, how effective some of the treatment interventions are that we're trying in this country and are trying in different parts of the world. The intervention or the creation of the Drugs Monitoring Centre in Lisbon, to me, will be a very important step, a very important institution in developing our ideas and our thinking on those areas. So I think the first lesson, if I can call it that, or the first point I want to emphasize is that in looking at the drugs problem, the international community needs to see it on an international basis. It needs to see it in the context of the communities that are supported and survive on this drugs trade, if I can call it that, and it needs to look beyond its own borders or its borders with its friends and neighbors. I think also it needs to have a much clearer view about its own policies. There seems to be, certainly from a media point of view, the whole issue seems to hinge on whether we legalize some substances or whether we don't. I think it's crucial that a national drugs strategy, and clearly we have influenced the European drug strategy, has again within its own shores a very balanced view. I am convinced that the view of this side of the spectrum, that it's a criminal justice issue, is equally as untenable and will not achieve what we want to achieve, as is the other side, even internally within our countries, that it is just a health and safety issue. What we've got in this country, and the International Narcotics Control Board has commended the strategy in this country, is a very balanced approach. The whole basis of the strategy is on prevention. We want to prevent things happening. We want our children to live drugs-free lives. We want them to achieve within the community without the need to rely upon drugs. We want people who are addicted to drugs to have available to them the treatment that is necessary to deal with their problems. And if you're thinking that I'm saying, okay, we're swinging over to this side of the pendulum, what we're doing in this country is saying that, yes, we can do that, but we need to do it in the context of the criminal justice system, and we don't need treatment or the criminal justice system. We have treatment and the criminal justice system. The two are interlinked. And treatment intervention by the police and in police stations, by the courts and in prisons, is something, when this is fully rolled out in this country, it will be one of the most comprehensive treatment intervention programs of any country in the world. But how can that be achieved? I've gone into some of the specifics. One of the big problems for governments is actually surrendering some of its responsibility, some of its power, some of its authority within the departmental structure that most governments have. It's quite understandable that the systems are based on ministries, and ministries deliver a product. I think most nations now will accept that in order to deliver a national drugs policy, then those agencies need to work together. Those ministries, when you look at the drugs issue, need to have an indistinction. It needs to be clear that they are working and operating together. Most of our European colleagues have got strategies that resemble that. Very few of them have ministries or a group of ministers with a corporate responsibility for that. Very few of them have budgets that are corporate budgets that reflect the strategy rather than are determined by the individual ministries putting money, putting their hand into their pockets to actually provide money to deliver programs. What the Prime Minister of this country said at the Fiera conference when we were pushing the drugs agenda with our European colleagues was that this is what would be necessary in order to deliver a drugs strategy internally. And we've got experience of 2.5 years on trying to make that happen. Part of my job is to try and help that, to be a flux by which different agencies, different ministries, and different departments can work together. It isn't easy. But I think that without an individual or a body, whoever he or she may be, who is not attached to a particular department, because where they are attached to Department of Health, then the whole psyche sees it as somewhere across on this side of the spectrum. When they're attached to the Ministry of the Interior, or the Home Office as we call it in this country, then the emphasis appears to be over this side of the spectrum. And I think we are the only country in the world where foreign policy and foreign affairs and foreign matters and intelligence is all part of the package. So in delivering a national strategy, and I think without a defensible national strategy that is balanced and is funded, without that, then it's very difficult for players on the international stage to say, we have clarity, we have direction, we have focus, and therefore let us sit round a table at an international level and have the same clarity, direction and focus. The media will not help that debate, and I appreciate there are a number of media people in the audience. It doesn't actually lead to headlines. It doesn't lead to sensation. Sensation is one minister disagreeing with another minister, or split between ministers, or split in the cabinet, or people are on the left, or people are on the right. That seems to make headlines. And what's happening at the moment in terms of where European nations are on this debate, and comparing United Kingdom with where we are in the context of Europe, I see all sorts of amazing statements about what is happening, what is not happening, in order, if I think that certainly if we didn't have a good enough relationship with our European colleagues, which could put governments at odds. So in terms of the internal strategies, then we need clarity of purpose. And sometimes that clarity of purpose is lost in the rhetoric of a quite convoluted and complex statement about what government wishes to do. I'd like to believe that ours is clear. Ours is a preventive model. It is to prevent the danger and damage to communities, to prevent the harm to young people, to their families. It is to provide the treatment and support. When I looked at the budget within the United Kingdom, when I first took the job, 62% of our total budget was spent on the criminal justice system. That actually showed where our balance was. That was on the police, the courts, the prison service. 12% was spent on education, 13% was spent on treatment. In the first budget proposals, I put to the government, I said that this was wrong. To actually devote two-thirds of our budget to getting it wrong just did not make sense. Now, it's interesting, I challenge other countries, and I'm sure they're represented here today, who are critical of the United Kingdom, saying, well, you've got a hardline policy, to assess what their percentage budget is spent on dealing with the consequences and preventing it happening in the first place. You get some very surprising results. We targeted in this country a change of emphasis. In the first year of the funded programme, we made a 7% shift in that balance. And clearly it's 7% off one side and 7% on the other. So it's quite a sensible and, I think, measurable shift within 1 year. That shift and that emphasis will continue. And I think in terms of that clarity, it's incumbent upon us to get those clear messages across. Because I speak to audiences maybe not as august as this, but I speak to, I don't know, certainly about 1,000 people a month. And I give this message across about what we are doing within the United Kingdom, but I rarely see it reported in the newspapers. What I see reported is we are just giving a just say no message in schools. Untrue. That we have a hard line on the medical use of cannabis. Untrue. And when people from other countries see that, they actually perceive us in the wrong way. And I'm finding, because of certainly my work with colleagues in Europe and in different parts of the world, we are equally perceiving their views in a distorted manner. So we need that clarity. We need to communicate that clarity of purpose. And we need to work with our European colleagues and our international colleagues in the international community to actually lay down our benchmarks in relation to that clarity and our purpose. It's time for me to end. But I think that what I've learned, certainly over the 10 or 15 years I've been involved in this area, is that you can never take anything for granted. What you believe to be the situation and what you perceive as the situation, whether it's in your own community, whether it is in the international scene, or whether it is globally, that is not seen in that way by many other people. What I've also seen is that there's been a lot of time and energy wasted on this problem. That simple, what are seen as simple, single solutions do not work. They actually have the potential to make it worse rather than make it better. What I've also learned is that there aren't any single simple solutions. And there's comprehensive, sophisticated solutions we attempt to introduce themselves are not easy. And it's not easy to show you've prevented something. it's not easy to show where there isn't information and baselines when you can actually show that you're making a difference. And because the situation is so volatile, and because there are so many conflicting views, and because people are so passionate about this, then they will use that lack of information, that lack of certainty, because we haven't had a real background or history in this, to pursue and to push their own views. For me, this is too serious a subject for it to be lost in that type of discussion or debate. Drugs clearly affect our lives in so many ways. And they are affecting, I'm sad to say, our children's lives in the ways that they didn't affect my generation. I think we've been too late. We are too late. We should have been doing and thinking what we're doing and thinking now 10 or 20 years ago. Thank you.
Thank you very much for giving such a bold, such a broad, and such a balanced introduction to a topic which, as you pointed out in your speech, is very rarely conducted in rational terms, is often incredibly polarised. And as the debate goes on, I think it becomes more and more confusing and less able to deliver the sorts of solutions that we're looking for. Keith has very kindly agreed to stay with us for another half hour answering questions and points from the audience. I'm going to take them in groups of three, and would be very grateful if people could introduce themselves before they speak, and if they could keep their points as short as possible. Who would like to start? So, gentleman in the back row. Can you wait until the microphone appears as well?
Hi. My name is Danny Kushlick. I'm director of Transform, the campaign for effective drug policy. We're campaigning, amongst other things, for the legalisation of all drugs because we think that's the most effective way forward. I'd just like to make a couple of points and then ask a question.
Can you make just one point?
I can indeed. Okay. I was surprised to hear that Keith was actually in Cleveland, in the police authority there, because they've actually just called for a substantive debate on the legalisation of all drugs because of the recognition that there is a problem with prohibition actually causing crime. Just to raise a point about the issues of how this affects communities. Communities aren't actually succeeding all that well under the programs that are currently going on. If you ask people from Brixton to Bogota what's actually happening there, they'll say that the same is happening there this year as was happening last year. Quick question. Does Keith think that prohibition actually causes more problems than it actually solves in terms of crime, health, and the kind of cultural and social problems that arise around use and misuse of drugs?
Okay. There's another gentleman on the back row with blue tie.
Yes, Glenn Siegel. Thank you very much for an interesting presentation. I'd actually like to link your policies to some other foreign policy agenda. Specifically, could you make some comments about what measures are being taken to prevent the revenue from the sales reaching the actual drug-producing areas, the producers themselves, and how this links to other foreign policy agenda, which is closely, as evidence suggests, is linked to that, such as the weapons trade, drug smuggling, which has a financing through actual diamonds, and something much more important, actually, in the human trade.
Okay. And can I take the third point? As a lady in the... Yes.
Hello,
can you... Wait for the microphone.
Hello, I'm Margaret Thomas. I'm a health economist. One of the things that always strikes me on the radio, when there's a haul of drugs, the street value is given, and it's normally enormous, the street value of £20 million was quoted the other day with one of these hauls. So in what way do you get a picture of the true amount of the drugs that are coming into Britain? Because obviously, if people are not caught, that's not appearing in the record anywhere.
Okay. Thank you. Very diverse questions. If I can take them in reverse order. Firstly, the street value of drugs and the true amount coming into the country. I certainly inherited a system where we did not know. And each year the old measures were how many drugs were seized by weight, and they did not distinguish between the type of drugs. So just as a matter of interest, we changed the policy so the agencies focus on what I described as the drugs that cause the major harm, which is heroin and cocaine. That doesn't mean, and I don't want Danny to jump up and down, that doesn't mean to say we're talking about legalizing cannabis, but we're focusing on those drugs. And the targets are to increase the seizures for those sort of drugs with an outcome of reducing their availability on the streets. Now that's pretty tough. The old measures were good, that were easy, forgive me. And politicians could stand up year on year and say, we've gone up 10% with our seizures. When I came to office, I asked the question, has that meant that there are reduced numbers on the streets, that their purity is reduced or the price is increased? And the reality is not the case. So therefore, you had measures in place that could be seen to be successful, but were actually not making a difference. And I don't like that subterfuge or dishonesty. What we set about doing is to establish, we know from various means the amount of crops, the raw materials that are grown. We know what is lost in processing, so each year we have a reasonable picture, that there are discrepancies, but a reasonable picture about what is grown. We know what we take out and how we take that out. And working with our European colleagues, and I've instigated some research, and hopefully I'm encouraging the applicant nations, the accession countries, to get involved in this, we will be able to assess, particularly, we're also, we've got core samples of drugs from all the regions each year. We've got them now. So we can see that this drug came from this region. The more countries that get involved in that sort of process, we will see what the network of drugs is, and we will have a clearer picture of what is coming, what is being taken out, and more importantly for me, how effective our interventions are at particular levels. So the short answer to your question is, we don't know. Estimates of cocaine vary between 10 and 20 tons a year. Now that's a big variation. Different methodologies we've tried of working back from the number of addicts that we believe there are and their consumption, which is pretty flaky. Please, I'm not suggesting this is empirical evidence that we can support. They have in the past tried street values purity, but they are, again, I think you can't really rely upon them because the street value of a particular drug changes from environment to environment, and depending on the people who are buying it, they will get the price that they can. So the short answer is I cannot give you a definitive answer to your question. What I can say, and we will have these figures in place next year, we will have a much clearer picture of how much comes in and how effective our interventions are. The second question, in relation to the revenue and sales reaching the countries of origin. At one level, and please don't think this is trivial, because it is actually shown to be quite effective. We've been training dogs to sniff drugs and clearly other things, explosives, into this country. We have now trained dogs that sniff and identify money on the way out. The dogs that we have, and we haven't got many yet, and they're not operating in many regions, have sniffed out £10 million in 3 or 4 months. Now, if you think that perhaps at a source country, £1 million will buy a ton of drugs, clearly it won't buy it on the streets here, but it will do in a source country. And if you say, for example, 50% of that money is going into people's bank accounts or going into other businesses or going for profit, then potentially just with those few dogs for that small period at a very small number of venues, we potentially stopped 5 tons of drugs coming into this country. What we're doing on a broader scale is trying to convince the international community to tighten up its banking laws and access to banking systems. A large number of countries in the world have now acceded to that and have signed these international agreements. Many of them are paying lip service to it. They may have signed them, but they're not actually operating them. And many, and I think it would be inappropriate here for me to name them, I could, but I'm not going to do, many of them are resisting it either because of corruption or because they have got some vested interest in allowing money to be, or their countries or their banks, to be used as security and as safety for criminality. What the international community have got to do, and this is where the selfishness perhaps needs to change, the selfishness perhaps that says, I don't want to upset them because I have a good trading relationship with them, the selfishness that says that, we need the strength of the international community to say, you must not do that. We are also here, in the Queen's speech, you will see it, going to seize assets from people before conviction, civil forfeiture. Clearly, there is a human rights issue here, and the tack we are taking will involve the courts, will involve the judicial process, but still, the individual will have to prove that their assets were gained by legal means. Certainly, our European colleagues are interested in that legislation. The accession nations that I've visited are interested in it. If we can get the international community to develop those types of measures, then rather than taking out a family in Bolton or Bristol or a Turkish drugs dealer or arms dealer, then if the international community didn't have a dawn raid on 5 venues in the north of England, but the international community had dawn raids on international institutions that are fostering and supporting these trades, then we really will make a difference. That's the sort of thinking we are encouraging. Can I come to the legalization debate and hopefully not spend too much time on it? I don't want, and I believe me, I can rehearse and talk to you for 20 minutes on why I believe drugs should not be legalized and freely available. There's a lot of untruths and mistruths on both sides of this debate. Please, Daddy, I'm not suggesting it's one-sided. That actually support or are against legalization. My view is the international community has set the agenda for which drugs should remain illegal. My view is that countries themselves will determine how they deal with their citizens, providing, coming back to a point I was making earlier, that the way they deal and interpret those laws do not affect other citizens in other countries. I feel that my own view is against legalization of drugs. I believe that I would rather operate within the context of a legal framework. And I feel that within this country, by focusing on the drugs that cause the major harm, by changing the targets and performance indicators of the criminal justice agencies, by setting the agenda to move towards preventing things happening through education rather than dealing with the consequences, we've got the balance right within the context of the international community. And yes, it is right to say, I've reported today the second report on progress in a 10-year program. It is right to say that things aren't changing as quickly as I would like. What I do believe, and I would hope that you would give this new program a chance, it's different. It really is different. And I think it will make a difference. And I think it will make a difference within the context of the criminal justice system rather than take the risk, in my mind, of taking away the legal constraints and operating in an environment that I would be very worried about.
Okay. Can we have the next group of questions? Sorry. The second row from the back, gentlemen.
If you don't mind, I'm on crutches. I'm Michael Butler of the Foreign Policy Centre's Advisory Council. I was very interested in what Keith Hannibal said about Pakistan. I wonder if he could just explain to us briefly what the... Not working? I wonder if he could just explain to us briefly what the decision-making process was, what countries are part of the party to it. I'm speaking as into it as much as I possibly can. What countries were involved in deciding to take out the poppy crop in Pakistan and how it is decided?
Okay. Do we have any mics up there?
Yeah.
Oh, right, wonderful. Can we have these two people up on the top row for this?
Yeah, Melanie Howard, Future Foundation. I know you don't want to get into the legalisation debate, but it seems impossible to talk about this subject without discriminating between different types of drugs and drug taking. And I'm struck from our own studies of social trends that the general direction of how people are developing is for greater self-expression, exploration, multiculturalism. People want more new experiences than they've ever wanted before. And this seems to me that, you know, if you're going to take out the recreational use of drugs and accept, you know, and not really consider what that might mean as a sort of separate category, then you're really souring the whole debate, because you've got to be able to distinguish between the different levels. And I just wondered what you made a statement, you said we don't want our children to grow up in a world with drugs. Well, actually, I'm not sure that's true. I'd like my children to have the choice of taking recreational drugs or not. What can you say to that? And I consider myself to be an upright citizen in every other regard.
Hello, my name's Steve Peak, an ex-student at the LSE and currently working with the Green Party on their drugs policy. And I'd like to echo the comments just made, particularly the comments made by you about your wish to bring up your children to live drug-free lives. Now, I wonder how many people in this room live drug-free lives. How many people never have a glass of alcohol? How many people never smoke a cigarette? I mean, really? I mean, do you really think that you're going to be able to bring children up to live drug-free lives? How much understanding do you have of teenage or young adult psychology to believe that by telling a kid not to do something because it's naughty, forbidden, that that's going to make them less likely to do it? Because the work that we do in clubs, which is focused on harm reduction, trying to empower and inform young people to use safe drugs in a safe place, has much more impact, has much more credibility. And credibility really is the key here, than a prohibitionist attitude which says that all drug use is wrong.
Ask a question.
Yeah, I'm getting there, if you can allow me. All drug use is wrong. All drug use is harmful. Because most young people who use drugs recreationally just know that that's not the case. And for you to come here and try and argue that case really just serves to show how out of touch you are with most of young people and their culture. So what are you doing to consult with young people? What are you doing to ask young people about their cultural preferences and their cultural values to inform a policy that reflects everybody's cultural values and not just your own?
Thank you very much.
Firstly, I'd be interested to know, for the last question, whether they've actually read either the strategy in this country or have read the material that go into schools or have spent time in schools looking at the programs that we are introducing. Because, quite frankly, you are either just pursuing a misinformation for the benefit of your own cause, or you're actually ignorant as to what is happening. There isn't a just... Well, forgive me.
You asked a long question. Can you let Keith Hallowell answer it, please?
There isn't a just say no policy in our schools. We start with children at the age of five and explain to them the nature and consequences of substance. We start with substances, their parents' pills and potions that may be legally prescribed. We move on to, and at that time, solvents and lighter fuels from which a number of our children die. We then move into alcohol and tobacco, we then move into drugs that have been prescribed as illegal. We actually tell them the nature and consequences, the positive sides of actually getting involved with these and the negative sides. We actually tell them the medical, social and legal consequences of being involved with these substances. Clearly, children will make their own choice. We want them to make informed choices. We want them to make, I personally do, you may not, and you, madam, may not. I want them to make choices not to get involved with these substances. I've been in a school this morning. I listened to, rather than speak to, probably 2,000 teenagers and young people a year. You may deal with a lot more than that. And their views are reflected in our strategy. Their views, forgive me, are reflected in our strategy. And the other thing that's interesting, I was on the radio this morning with a Welsh father who said he'd been liberal with his daughter. She died over the weekend by taking an ecstasy tablet. He'd given advice, she'd been given guidance, but she took an ecstasy tablet and she's now dead. I don't know how you reconcile or would reconcile that if there was a death in your family. I see parents' groups, I see parents against drugs, I see a lot of parents who have suffered because their children either have been killed or their children have bunked off school, they've lost their life and their lives are wasted. They certainly feel extremely passionately about this. But to say that our policy is either just say no or doesn't reflect the views of the children or doesn't discriminate between legal or illegal drugs or gives one particular line is absolutely untrue. I think that drug taking and experimentation clearly is a part of growing up. And clearly, in my mind, children need to understand the nature and consequences of what they are doing. I think that in the past we haven't given them that. And I think messages that did not discriminate or did discriminate between legally obtained and illegal, saying these are all right or we ignore them because we do it, and these are wrong because we say they're illegal, are clearly ineffective, totally ineffective. Therefore, I think it's important that children make choices. It isn't a totalitarian state. Forgive me, your child can make the choice to get involved in drugs, but your child needs to know the consequences, not just the legal consequences. But he or she needs to know the social consequences, and they need to know the medical consequences of getting involved. That is what we're telling them. As far as the process in Pakistan and the decision-making, I don't really know. I think that I wasn't actually about or involved in that process at that time. But I think that coming back to this sort of selfish approach, if I could call it that, I think people look at, you know, what's in it for me and what is best for me or what is best for my country. I think the United Nations Drugs Control Programme certainly had a hand in that, and we contribute to that. The Americans clearly had a hand in that because they put a lot of constraints on trade until the Pakistani government showed that they'd virtually eradicated the poppy. Interestingly enough, at the moment, I'm looking at the way in which the poppy is harvested. When there was a shortfall in the poppy crop, to provide the legally required drugs, particularly for America, they put pressure on the Indian government to increase the licenses to farmers to grow more poppies. At the same time, where they're putting pressure on the Pakistani government to reduce the poppy crop. The economies of those countries are perhaps not dissimilar. One questions why, from an economical point of view, we didn't relax constraints on Pakistan. So I think this situation goes and continues. One of the newspapers, I think represented here, I don't know whether he's actually turned up, in looking at this, I talked about, you know, what is the future of Afghanistan? Is there? Question. Please, I don't want that tomorrow Tsar says this for the media in the audience. But shouldn't we be looking at Afghanistan and looking at the economy of Afghanistan in a way that perhaps we didn't look at the economies of Pakistan and perhaps India when we made decisions in the past? Those are the sort of questions I'm asking. I'm not saying I'm coming up with the answer because of the political context of Afghanistan.
Okay, can we have another round of questions? Lady in the front row.
Can I say to the audience, I'm happy to stay for a while, so it's if you want to get up and go because you have to go, fine, but I'm not an attendee for I'm, I was going to do Newsnight, but it's not happening now. They've cancelled me because of the American election, so we're okay for a while.
Okay, I'll ask a long question then. I just want to ask you about the European level.
Can you introduce yourself?
Yes, sorry, Heather Graby from the Centre for European Reform. I wanted to ask about the European level and your views on the role of Schengen and Justice and Home Affairs cooperation in drugs policy. Would it be helpful for Britain to be part of a European drugs policy, which is also connected with Schengen, or would the loss of border controls and potentially the impact of other countries' drugs policies, to mention no names, the Netherlands, would that counteract the effect of having a European drugs policy? What's your view on how it should develop from here?
Okay, second question is the gentleman on the edge.
Keith Middlemiss, formerly it's the University of Sussex. It's possibly a rather dry question about the machinery of government, but I rather like the idea of a national strategy which is nationally funded. And you did say something about surrender of ministerial sovereignty, I phrase, which I presume you mean the Home Office, which has perhaps been due for a demolition job for a long time. The rivalries seem to me considerable. They're not merely rivalries of information, they're rivalries of ethos between police, courts, judges, intelligence services, and so on. And this, I think, lies behind the 60%, 30% division of funds. And it also concerns the question of leadership. Who actually leads on this? I don't mean you yourself, I mean in the political sense and ministerial sense. Should it actually continue to be the Home Office?
Okay, can I take a third question in that group? There's a gentleman in the second row here, I think he's been waiting for a long time. Oops, no,
Hello. Ken Eckersley of Narconon Drug Rehabilitation. I was very interested in what Keith has had to say. And I refer back to what he said about drug treatment and testing orders. In this country, these are only recently implemented, and they depend upon two things, testing and treatment. Abroad, I think, for instance, of the town of Prior in Utah, in the United States, they have a very effective program there, and they have a very effective treatment. 69% of the people they put through their treatment get off drugs permanently. That is not the case here, as the big issue in the North investigation of about a year ago has revealed, and since then the Northwest Drugs Commission has recognized that the only treatment, in inverted commas, in Great Britain is methadone treatment used on a maintenance basis, which actually cures nothing whatsoever. What I'd like to ask Keith is, if we're going to have successful drug testing and treatment orders, isn't it time we looked at the real problem in our prisons and everywhere else, and that is the introduction of treatment that actually procures a result in terms of lifelong abstinence? Other countries can do it. This country is not doing it. I wonder if we may investigate why.
Okay. Thank you. Take them in reverse order. I was appalled at the findings of the big issue because, I was appalled at the findings of the big issue. And I think that the idea in the past was that the way to deal with people with drugs problems was to actually give them a script. And that script would be methadone and benzos or whatever is described, and really park them on these drugs. That was it. And the resources coming behind, that should come behind, either for the abstinence programs or to help deal with the root causes or the problems that created drug use in the first place were absent. And it was a superficial exercise. And one of the things that we're looking at in terms of the way in which we can be more effective is the end product. And some of the performance indicators that certainly I'm looking at are stability indicators, stability in housing, stability in relationships, stability in employment, stability in further education, rather than saying it's either crime-free or drugs-free or whatever. But we have a long way to go. And the strategy does not talk about maintenance. That's the point that I know that sort of up in the gods you've taken exception to. And it is, if you say we're happy for people to live being maintained by a drug or being supported by a drug, I think that misses the point. We want them to not to have that reliance upon drugs. Now, before I'm jumped at from great height, that doesn't mean, certainly in relation to legal drugs, that we talk about abstinence in relation to those. But clearly, we won't want people to have to rely upon legal drugs. And in that, I mean, there are estimated 4 million people in this country addicted to sleeping tablets, addicted to legally prescribed drugs, which is an issue that certainly I'm looking at, that we need to look at as a community. So the whole basis of our programs and our philosophy is that people live drugs-free lives. Not easy to achieve because it questions some of the perceived belief of just maintain them, leave them up there. There is another issue about methadone. Whilst I think working with the Royal Pharmaceutical Society and doctors and drug agencies are reducing leakage of methadone and reducing long-term large prescribing of methadone, methadone is almost like a brand name, Hoover, or should I say, what's the new one now? Dyson.
Yes.
What I'm so concerned about, that we've asked our European colleagues, who particularly during the French presidency, if they will bring together a program and some experts to look at what substances are available, how effective are they, so that doctors have got a broader, and I know that perhaps we would all like people not to have to rely upon these substances at all, but what are the best available substances to support people with drugs problems. In that regard, in this country, many of you may know, we have a number of doctors licensed to prescribe legal heroin. I get regaled or lambasted by some of the foreign press saying, you know, why don't we support shooting clinics and all of these things. For 25 years, doctors in this country have had to prescribe legal heroin. Very few of them do. Very few of them feel that it's the right way to go. The second point about government. The model we adopted when I first came in terms of budgeting was that the budget would be split. And so I chaired the cross-departmental spending review and went to Gordon Brown's committee to bid for the budget to drive the drug strategy forward. All the departments, 16 of them, because you think that the breadth of this, and the first one included Scotland, Northern Ireland and Wales, had to bid for the amount of money they wanted, whether it was for police, courts, treatment, whatever. That corporate bid went forward. The corporate bid came back. The model we adopted, because remember, I'm a sort of unusual. They haven't had somebody in this position in the past. Was it would go into the departments. The departments would operate together at local level through what we describe as drug action teams, and they would virtually create a budget. So they would say, we would surrender our budget at local level for the greater good of this community in developing these corporate strategies. It didn't work. People were reluctant to give up the money in support of a common cause. So the second spending round, the new spending round that we've got, we have pooled budgets. There is a pooled prevention budget, there is a pooled treatment budget, and we are creating something called the National Treatment Agency, which will deliver against that budget and against standards. And there is an availability budget that all the agencies who will deliver on the availability target will corporately put forward their bids, and I'm part of that process, so that money will be given on a corporate basis. It is cutting-edge government. It is cutting-edge government. So this is a second model within the space of 3 years. As far as your question about who leads, I think
The Home Office doesn't lead, so there you've actually got a misconception there. I'm appointed by the Prime Minister. I'm special advisor to the Prime Minister and the government. I'm a member of, and I've just come from it now, a ministerial steering group which is chaired by the Cabinet Minister, hence you see Mo Molden, Minister responsible for drugs policies. On that group is the Secretary of State for Health, Secretary of State for Education, the Secretary of State for Home, Jack Straw, the Foreign Secretary, but usually he's represented by the Minister responsible for drugs, the Treasury, First Minister of the Treasury, Andrew Smith, and myself. And so we meet on, it was a monthly basis, it's now a six weekly basis to actually determine that the strategy being driven forward on a corporate basis. I think that is unique. Oh, sorry, does that? No, there's one more, sorry. Schengen. I think that I was involved on Trevi. There was something called Trevi, you may recall, and it an institution where we were looking at these issues. And at that time, the issue of Schengen came up, and it was this government's decision not to join Schengen. Schengen took a lot of time to get off the ground, and there are still critics, as you well know, of Schengen. Our membership or otherwise of Schengen doesn't affect our contribution to the European drugs strategy. We are a very positive supporter of that European drugs strategy. FIERA, the conference in FIERA, the EU conference in FIERA, which was a very important one, we had a number of recommendations that the Prime Minister, should I say, drove through, got agreement on in FIERA, which put a harder edge on the European drug strategy. My view of it, I had a long session with Vitorino, and my view was that whilst it looked all right, and it had some sort of idea what we're going to do, it wasn't outcome based, it didn't have any hard measures, and in 5 or 10 years you could say, well, we've gone down this path, have we really achieved anything? Also, drugs were found in all the pillars of the EU. Now there is a cross-cutting, as you know, cross-cutting review, cross-cutting department, but you've got to look all over the place to find it. What we achieved at that was to say, let's pull all of this out, and whilst we couldn't add it as a new precondition to the accession nations, what we are doing, and I'm going round on behalf of the EU, I'm going round all the accession nations, I've been to four, and I'm going to go through them all, is to almost use it as a precondition, to say you have these clear preconditions in economy, for human rights, for all of these things. Really, if you want to join the club, these are the standards you really need to achieve. And that's exactly what I'm doing, part of my job I'm doing at the moment. So you can support that strategy, we can influence it, we can actually develop it without being a member of Schengen.
Thank you very much for all those comprehensive answers. I'm really grateful to you for coming along on what must have been a hellish day with the publication of the report today, which I know started very early with media briefs and has been fairly relentless until now. I'd really also like to thank Jeremy Paxman for letting us
well, he's in
keep
America,
you a bit
actually.
Longer.
It was Kirsty.
Well, Kirsty as well. And I think that the biggest thanks is really to you. I'd like to thank you on behalf of the audience for coming, sharing your time and ideas with us this evening, for being so open to questions, for being so balanced. So thank you very much, Keith. Before people leave, there are a few other things I'd like to say. First of all, to thank the LSE for helping us stage this event and providing such a fantastic venue for this evening, particularly to Claire Devaney, who's been really helpful throughout the process. Big thank you also to Barry, Mirene and Kate Ford for making tonight possible at the Foreign Policy Centre. And before you leave, just allow me to make a couple of minor plugs for future Foreign Policy Centre events. First is on the 20th of November. We're having a big conference on the US and the world, looking at what the effects of tonight's election are for multilateralism. If you want details of that, you can get them at the stall outside. Also doing a whole series of lectures on global health. The first one is on the World AIDS Day, looking at AIDS as a problem, which you can also get details from there. And finally, a pamphlet on the future shape of Europe with contributors from Tony Blair and Giuliano Amato to Tony Giddens, the director of the LSE, which tries to put together a radical, bold agenda for the future of the European Union, which gets out the stale debate between federal and non-federal solutions, which will launch a major European programme. Please collect information on your way out. And I think there might be a few people in this room who aren't subscribers to the Foreign Policy Centre yet. Tonight would be a fantastic time to put that right. You can get forms on your way out as well. It's a bargain at £45 this evening if you sign up tonight. But thank you very much for coming. Some of you will hopefully stay with us for a few more minutes for some drinks and other refreshments in a different part of the building. And finally, just good night. Thank you to you. Thank you to Keith.